Welcome to Murder with the Misses. I'm Darren.
And I'm Amy. And today we're going to tell you the story of Angie Dodge.
Not Hodge.
Not Hodge. I originally said Hodge. We had to completely start over. I'll get myself together, I promise. Mm-hmm. These days, DNA is very important. If you have DNA, it's basically an open and shut case, right? Let me tell you where you're wrong. We're going to Idaho Falls, Idaho. Angie was a good kid, the youngest of four kids, and she was very intelligent. She was actually bullied when she was younger because she was like 5'11 or 6 feet tall, somewhere around there. So she started noticing when other kids were getting picked on and would always stand up for them. She was just 18 years old when she got into a disagreement with her mom, Carol, about a household rule. That's all they've ever said. And she decided to move out. So it seems like one of them parent moves where as long as you're under my roof, so the kid's like, I'll get out from under your roof because, you know, they know everything at 18.
Oh, yeah. And then when they get out, then they're like,
can I come home?
Can I come home?
I don't like adulting.
Yeah, this sucks.
We could have told you that.
Yeah.
She moved into a two-story house that had been converted into apartments, and her mom even helped her move, so there was really no hard feelings. She lived on her own for about 3 weeks, and the night before the incident that we're going to talk about today, they had a long talk and made sure that the air was clear, so all was good there. On June 13th of 1996, Angie didn't show up for work, and that was unlike her, so two of her coworkers went to the house to check on her. They found her laying on her back on the floor next to her bed. Her sweatpants were kind of pulled down, like one side was up by her hip and the other side was halfway down her thigh. And her shirt was pulled up enough that they were able to see a deep cut to one of her breasts. Angie had been stabbed 16 times, sexually assaulted, and her throat was cut so deep that she was almost decapitated.
Yeah, this was a horrible crime scene. But the cops were able to get semen and hair samples.
Yeah, some of them downstairs hair samples, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah. They did not worry about DNA. I don't know if the killer just didn't think it was a real thing or if they just really didn't care because they were very sloppy. They got so much evidence out of this place, which sounds good, right?
Yeah, it should be open shut.
I mean, you would think. Police believe that she may have been attacked while she was getting ready for bed late the night before or very early the next morning. And all the DNA came back linked to one man. So they knew that they were looking for one man right off the bat. Like there was nothing anywhere else. No fingerprints, no other semen, no other hair sample, nothing. They just didn't know who that man was. They tested over 100 men in the area, but nothing. They started looking into her friends. See, she used to hang out with some friends at Snake River, and they were lovingly referred to as river rats. So they started there. Several months after Angie's death, river rat Ben Hobbs was arrested for raping a woman at knife point in Nevada. They brought him in at the end of 1996, beginning of 1997-ish, for questioning, since this fit the same MO as Angie's killer. But he wouldn't confess, and only gave them so much information. He wasn't there for any of their shenanigans, based on some of the interview footage that I saw of him. It's actually kind of funny, because he's literally pushing back on the cops. Like, you can tell 100% this guy was like, I know I wasn't there, I don't give a shit what you say, get off my ass, the whole time. And they had also been interviewing 20-year-old Christopher Tapp, and asking him about Hobbs. Chris denied knowing anything. He said he didn't even know the layout of the house she lived in. Now, Chris was interviewed on January 7th and released. He was interviewed again on January 10th, and they went ahead and scheduled him again for a third interview the next day on the 11th. But when they were asking for that third interview, Chris decided to get a lawyer, and he also decided he wasn't going back in again. Police came to his house, and his mom told him as much and said he and his lawyer would come and talk to them on the 13th after his lawyer got a chance to review the case. But the cops decided that they didn't want to wait. They got themselves a warrant and charged Chris with being an accessory to a felony.
Since his DNA didn't match the DNA at the scene, they figured he was there and possibly assisted in the murder.
Yeah, so now they're like, okay, there was more than one person there.
Okay.
Even though they had no proof of other people there. But you can't really rule it out, I guess, because just because somebody didn't drop hair samples or touch anything doesn't mean that they weren't there, I guess.
Okay, so now they're reaching.
They're reaching very far. Okay. I think I'm going to post a picture of this poor kid, what he looked like, and he looks like a baby in these interrogation tapes. It's so sad. Now, in all three interviews at this point, he'd given different stories. He was given like 5 or 7, depending on what report you read. Of course, with these, there's always multiple different answers. But it was no minimum of 5, maximum of 7 polygraph tests. And he was failing them right and left. Every time they told him that he failed and interrogated him again. He was interrogated for over 60 hours. And I'm not going to lie, it was hard to watch some of these interrogation tapes. They are clearly feeding him information until he manages to pass a polygraph. He said that she lived on the corner of the street and her house was in the middle. Chris said she was attacked in the living room. She was attacked in her bedroom. Chris said she was cut once. She was stabbed 16 times. He clearly had no clue. So they would show him crime scene photos and feed him the correct information. And after so many hours of this and threats of the death penalty, he did sign a confession. They managed to convince him that he had just repressed the memories of the attack. And like I said, I'm going to post a picture of when he finally passed his polygraph and the cop is shaking his hand. And he literally looks like a little boy hooked up to this machine. It's very heartbreaking because you can tell he was just so young and they managed to manipulate him into a false confession.
Knowing damn good and well the damn polygraphs, they can't even use that shit in court.
No, they can't. They can't. But they were just trying to get him to believe it. If he could give enough information to where he believed he'd done this.
Yeah, let me tell you. Let me tell you over and over and over that you did it until you finally believe it.
Exactly. Like I said, they told him, oh, you just repressed the memory. That's what happens when things like this happen. Yeah. Oh, ho, ho, ho. And they also offered Chris immunity at one point if he would just confess to holding Angie down while she was assaulted and killed by 2 other guys. Now they've got 3 people in this crime scene as suspects. So they just keep getting worse and worse.
Why would you give immunity? Why would you even offer immunity to somebody if you think that they had something to do with it?
Well, because first you talk, first to what?
Because they're reaching.
What he was wanting to do was he was wanting Chris to give them the other 2 people. And they had 2 people in mind. I'm sure you're shocked about that. But they already had the 2 people there. And they're like, well, what about this person? Well, what about this person? And he's like, I don't know. And so they just kept feeding him until he's like, yeah, they were totally there. They totally did it. But never mind, we'll get into it. I get so mad.
Yeah, doing their finest work.
As usual. Now, like I said, they offered Chris immunity, and then they ended up taking that back, actually. And they told him that if he did not throw these 2 other guys under the bus and confess to his part, that he would get the death penalty if he kept denying it. So now he's faced with the threat of a lethal injection, or in Idaho now, in 2023, actually, last year, they reinstated a firing squad. So back then, it would have been lethal injection. And I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not a judge. And I know that cops can lie to you. That's a fact. Everybody knows that. They're allowed to lie. But what they can't do is threaten you. Plus, they had the DNA from 1 person, and now they got 3 people. And scared Chris was just offering up whatever name they told him to. One, like we said, was Ben Hobbs. He wasn't there for their games, remember? And he knew he didn't do it. They couldn't match his DNA or push him into a false confession like they did Chris, so they had to release him. Another one was Jeremy Sargis, but it was the same situation as Hobbs. And he wouldn't confess, and his DNA didn't match, so they ended up having to release him too.
Yeah, but Chris was convicted in December of 98 and got a minimum of 30 years to life in prison.
Yeah.
On the video of his sentencing, you can hear Carol say, Merry Christmas.
Yeah, that was actually, at the time when I was watching it, I was like, that's a mom who was really like, got him. She was very there for that.
And just, you know, and that's just, I mean, okay, if it was the actual person, okay.
And at the time, everybody thought, I mean, all they don't know at this point, all the interrogations. They don't know all of the promises and the threats and the polygraph test. They don't know all of this because they only tell them about the parts where he confessed, not the parts where he fucked up and didn't have the right information or things like that. So to her and the family, this was perfect. Well, they got the guy.
Well, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, she said. And I was like, yep, that's a mom who's pretty happy that this is going on. And she was. She was very happy he was going to prison. But she really wanted him to get the death penalty at this point. Now, after a few years, this didn't sit right with Miss Carol. She was stuck on the fact that none of the DNA matched to Chris. So even if he was at the scene, it doesn't appear that he was the only one who assaulted and killed her. Yet, there had been no other arrests since Chris. And she was a regular at the police station at this time. She went every day. She would even pop in through the back door to surprise them and make sure they were working. They even nicknamed that back door Carol's door. She requested the interrogation tapes for Chris, hoping that she could pick up on something to help her own investigation. And she said watching these tapes made her want to put her fist through the TV. And I can understand that. So she switched gears. In 2008, she brought on Stephen Drizin, the co-director of the Center of Wrongful Convictions at Northwestern University, and contacted Chris's lawyer. They all reviewed the tapes. Stephen said that the tape showed evidence of coercion from the police and threatening the death penalty, leading to a possible false confession. And they started working on that. They brought in genetic genealogist C.C. Moore, and she's a little badass. She came in and looked at the DNA. And what happened was a man named Michael Usry Sr. submitted his DNA to the Sorensen Project for recreational or religious purposes. Ancestry.com purchased the databases of the DNA from the Sorensen Project, and it was available to the public. Carol's team was able to match the DNA from Angie's case to a close relative of Michael Usry Sr. because of a 34 out of 35 match on the alleles. That was not Chris. Cece started making a family tree, and they accused Michael Usry Jr. because when they looked into him, they saw that he liked to make graphic amateur horror films, one that bore an eerie resemblance to Angie's murder. But when they tested his DNA, it wasn't the match that they needed. That did, however, prompt Michael Jr. to get involved in the case, and he and Carol actually became friends.
It also brought on a lot of issues for Ancestry.com for any type of public database.
Oh, yeah. People started getting pissed because you've got this guy, Michael Sr., who donated his DNA to the Sorensen Project, and then all of a sudden his shit is on Ancestry.com available for anybody.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, when they found out about this, were pissed. They're like, no, that's not what we gave our DNA for. But now here you are just letting anybody get a hold of it.
Sorry about you. More than likely you signed a waiver when you gave it.
I don't think they did.
I bet they did.
I think that was the issue, and that's why Ancestry no longer has public databases. I was going to get to that later, but we'll talk about it now.
Whatever.
Yeah, they got in some trouble for that. So Carol's team is working the DNA angle really hard, and Carol is helping Chris's lawyer to get him released. During all this time, he had recanted his confession, and he had appealed about a million times. His DNA was tested again, and guess what? Still was not a match. He was getting help from the Idaho Innocence Project, too. And in 2017, finally, Chris was brought into court and the judge dropped the rape charge, meaning that Chris would no longer have to be a registered sex offender. But they kept the murder charge. They did give him time served for that, since he had been in jail for 20 years, and he was released. Chris and Carol held hands as they walked out of the courthouse that day. It's interesting to see a victim's parent help free the man convicted of the murder. We'll get to more of him later, but we need to talk DNA. Idaho Falls Police Captain Squires and Cece looked into GEDmatch and were able to, so GEDmatch is like a database of a bunch of databases. So like everything comes into one spot. It's kind of nice to have, but they were able to narrow it down to one couple who the suspect had to be a descendant of. And Cece found one that looked like a possible match. And the police were able to obtain some DNA on the down low, but it wasn't him. So Cece went back to the drawing board and started looking at divorces. One of the descendants that was married was, or one of the descendants was briefly married and then divorced. And when Cece started researching, she found out that the woman was pregnant during the time of that divorce.
Her son was going by his stepfather's last name, not his biological father's last name.
Right. So he wasn't following the chain. It wasn't popping up for her family tree because it's some random guy not in the tree. So they tracked him down. And this man was a creature of habit. So he had a pretty set schedule and he was a smoker. So that helped. They followed him. And he threw a cigarette out while going down the highway. But when the cops stopped to try to get it, there were so many butts on the road that they couldn't figure out which one was the right one. So they waited at a convenience store because this man usually went and got a pop around noon each day or a soda, depending on where you're from. Sure enough, he came and he was smoking. So he throws down his cigarette butt and leaves and they were able to snag it up. They ran the DNA and bam. Brian Lee Drips. He had actually lived across the street from the house that Angie was living in at the time of the crime, and he moved away shortly after. So they haul his ass in, and after a cigarette break, he slouched down in his chair, let out a sigh, and confessed. He said he was high on cocaine and drunk, that he only went in to rape her, but he guesses he killed her. He says he didn't remember that part, which... wow. He was convicted in 2021 and sentenced to 20 years to life in prison. So this just goes to show you that DNA is not always the slam dunk that we think it is.
So the police officers, the investigators in this story, you know, pushed the technology aside to get a quick close on this case and look where it got them.
Yeah, it was, I mean, now we're back to the actual DNA evidence. There's actually one person that did it.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, it was Mr. Drips. He was dripping his fucking DNA all over the fucking
gross,
place.
Gross. You nasty.
He drips. It's in his name.
You're gross.
Drippy drip.
No. Nope.
Yep. Threw his little drippy fucking cigarette out, and that's how they busted his ass.
Yep. That's true, too. That is true. But, I mean, at the same time, why didn't he come forward any of this time? I know nobody really wants to go to prison, but he knew he did this. He knew he did
well,
this.
Well, like I said, he was high on cocaine and...
drunk.
And he was drunk off his drip juice.
Is that the, she only want me for my drip juice? Edit that out.
Nope.
So let's talk... dick. Let's talk about what happened to Chris. We'll just move on then. After his release, he actually got married and he traveled the country telling his story. He helped get laws passed in two different states, setting a compensation scale for the wrongfully convicted. And he got a little compensation too. But he filed a lawsuit against the Idaho State Police Department and also fought to get that murder conviction off of his record. 2 years later, it was removed. And the city asked the judge to dismiss his lawsuit, but ultimately the city council approved a settlement. And in 2022, he settled his lawsuit for $11.7 million. The lawyer said, Chris Tapp's wrongful conviction should never have happened. DNA cleared him over 20 years ago. We hope that this settlement is a wake-up call to the many police departments still using the same practices of lying, deception, and coercion as Idaho Falls did, and that it still needs to reform so that other innocents don't suffer like Chris Tapp has. And Chris made a sizable donation to the Idaho Innocence Project, who helped get him freed, as well as bought his wife a Corvette. Unfortunately, he and his wife started divorce proceedings, and his wife died in a car accident before that was finalized. 2 months after that, Chris Tapp went to Las Vegas for a car show. It sounds like it was SEMA because it was at the end of October. He went because he was a sponsor for Odom Racing. On October 29th of 2023, 47-year-old Chris was found by friends in his hotel suite where it appeared that he had fallen and hit his head on the coffee table. He had cocaine in his system, and the cause of death from the autopsy showed blunt force trauma to the head and was ruled accidental. But he did have several brain bleeds.
Homicide detectives would find out later that there had been a, you know, altercation in the hotel room just before that.
Yeah, so they find out there was actually a fight in there, and so they got to looking into it a little bit more.
Man, that just sucks. You know, you go to prison,
yeah,
wrongfully.
For 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Get out. Finally, 2 years later, you get your money from the lawsuit. You get your record, your name cleared.
Yep. Yeah, he fought hard to get that murder charge off.
And then you start getting divorced after you buy your wife a Corvette.
And that was his gift to her.
Yeah. What, for the divorce?
From the settlement. No, when he got his settlement, he bought her a Corvette.
Bought her a Corvette. It's like, hey, happy divorce.
No. Before they filed divorce.
Oh, okay. Well, is it though?
Yes.
Okay. But anyway, and then 2 months later.
Yeah, 2 months later.
2 months later. Good night, man. You had all that freaking money and you want to go and...
What? He was living his life. He was making up for lost time. Don't look at me like that. His eyes are wide right now.
I could think of a lot better things to do rather than just go and have some cocaine and everything else and spend my money on bullshit.
He was sponsoring a car at SEMA.
Exactly. That'd be great.
Right. You
know? But take out all the rest of the crap.
I got you. Take out them drugs.
You know, you want to live your life? Live your life.
Yeah.
You deserve
drug free, though.
Yeah, drug free. Live your life.
It's the way to be.
Yeah, live high on life.
No, live high on life.
That's so stupid.
No, leave that in there. If you're going to leave me singing, you have to leave you saying live high on life.
I will.
Okay, good. Just recently, on March 6, 2024, former professional wrestler and congressional candidate Daniel Rodimer, whose ring name was Dan Rodman, which I don't understand why you wouldn't do a much cooler name, but either way, he was charged with open murder in connection with Chris's death. It is reported that Chris offered Rodimer's daughter, or stepdaughter, cocaine, and Rodimer hit him on the head out of anger. Chris was found an hour later by his friends who called 911. Rodimer did recently turn himself in and bonded out. He goes back to court on April 10th, which is going to be before this episode comes out, I think. But we're not going to probably know anything immediately, so this will be another one we'll do an update on. All suspects are innocent until proven guilty, but the press is eating this up. They report that Rodimer has had 3 prior arrests in Florida on suspicion of assault, but no convictions. And I don't understand suspicion of assault 3 times.
Well, you know, in 2018, his wife called 911 twice saying he assaulted her and stole guns and jewelry, and he was not arrested in either incident.
So I guess that's the suspicion. Somebody says, hey, he did it, but because they don't want to press charges, or because he is a congressional candidate, they don't want to press charges. I don't understand. I'm confused.
Yeah.
And it does sound like he had anger issues for some time, because that was 2018 and now we're talking about 2023. We'll have to see how that plays out. And Carol? Carol started AngieDodge.com, which accepts donations for Five for Hope. The site states that the funds will be to help nonprofit cold case foundations and underfunded police departments to test DNA samples and purchase equipment that will ultimately help solve cold cases. It actually helped solve a 40-year-old cold case in the murder of a 9-year-old girl, so she is still fighting for people to this day. She's badass. She's another one of those parents where you're like, she really pushed this. She's the one who made this change. Her and the Innocence Project are really the ones who are the heroes in this case.
That was Carol?
Yeah, Angie's mom.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's another parent one where they're the ones that are really doing the investigating.
Yeah, and I'm, you know, and it's great that she did what she did, but I mean, you know, to go, what was it, 10 years? She said a few years later, 10 years before she finally started looking into it because of...
No, it was only a few that she started looking into it, but it takes time. Like, she had to get everybody on board. They had to go through all the evidence. They had to look at all the things and get everything in line. Yeah. So she was still, it only took a couple of years for her to realize, hold on, if they're saying he just held her down and somebody else murdered her, where's the somebody else?
Exactly.
And like I said, she was at that police station every day going through Carol's door.
Well, and that's what I'm saying. It's just like, I don't know. They just, I don't know, these cops, they didn't do their job again.
And here they have DNA evidence pointing, and because her statement on this website says that it's to help underfunded police departments test DNA samples.
Yeah.
But they had it and they tested it and they still fucked it up.
Yeah, I know. That's why I just don't understand it, but.
Yeah, people. The human factor comes in.
Well, thanks for joining us on this one. Come catch us on the next one.
Bye.